You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Okay, welcome into a Wednesday edition of Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the only podcast that breaks down every Heat game, news item, rumor, and more. Thanks for listening on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on the brand new podcast app, Himalaya. My name is Wes Goldberg, and I'm here with David Ramil. We'll talk about Juwan Howard possibly taking the Michigan job later on and get David's thoughts on the Mike Conley rumors. But first, our friend Ira Winderman over at the Sun Sentinel recently wrote that the Heat will be focusing on building around Justice Winslow, Josh Richardson, Bam Adebayo, maybe even Derek Jones Jr., and won't be concerned as much about potential overlap with guys like Whiteside, Goran Dragic, Deion Waiters, James Johnson. Obviously, this has repercussions for what they do in free agency, though they're going to be limited in flexibility. But it starts with the draft in June, meaning that the Heat won't be afraid to draft a player who plays the same position as one of those veterans. What do you think about the Heat going forward with the young guys in mind? I mean, this is definitely the right move, right, David?
It's absolutely the right move, but I don't know that I'd necessarily trust this franchise to handle it if another opportunity to acquire an older veteran comes along. The reality is that they'll bank on the future and the young prospects on this team for as long as they're productive until somebody else, perhaps potentially better, comes along. We saw last year, they were willing to trade away, theoretically or allegedly, reportedly, a couple of the young core pieces in exchange for a Jimmy Butler type. And I think that's going to continue to be the MO for this team. Like, as much as they like, I think, guys like Justice and Josh and Bam, and maybe even to some extent Derek Jones Jr., I think they're all eminently movable if a established star comes along, regardless of their
age. Are those two things mutually exclusive? Like, is it fair to say that while this team is intact, sort of, you build around those young pieces, but obviously if superstar player X comes along and it takes moving a couple of those young pieces, you just do it, and then you pivot from there. But if that trade doesn't materialize, if that trade isn't out there, then I guess in the meantime you're just building around these three or four guys.
Yeah, but I mean, it's that in the meantime part, I think, that weighs, especially on the young players themselves. I mean, if they're seeing themselves as centerpieces or building blocks for the team's future, and the reality is that they're not, it's kind of hard to buy into it. And I mean, look, I think we all know the NBA and the business side of things keeps everybody on their toes, and no player, no matter how great, with the exception of maybe a Durant or a LeBron, is exempt from being moved or traded at any given moment if somebody else comes along. And the reason those two aren't is because nobody else can come along. They are the best in the league. Maybe you can include Curry in there as well. So I understand that perspective. I guess it just makes it a little bit more difficult. And I think that was part of what weighed down on this team last year also. Even though they were able to move on to camp and Jimmy Butler was traded shortly afterwards, and it didn't really have any kind of exact repercussions on the roster, I think that kind of impacted how these players saw themselves, whether or not they were building blocks for the future, what their roles were and things of that sort. And I mean, that is a challenging thing to deal with, especially at 24, 25 when you're mostly unproven.
Well, no, it's a fair thing to say, because this team wasn't built around those guys last year, right? This team, they just sort of elevated themselves because they ended up being kind of the best players on the team last year. And if you're going to rebuild this roster isn't built around them now. So if you are going to rebuild around them now, A, what does that look like?
Right.
B, how committed are you to that? Because if you are committed to it, then those guys do feel empowered, like what you're saying. But, okay, so you build around this group. You empower Justice, Josh, and Bam. You put them in the starting unit, and you put the other guys around them to complement their skill sets, right?
Right.
Well, then what happens if, because like you said, nobody's safe in this league. DeMar DeRozan can get traded, even if he's the face of the franchise, if Kawhi Leonard comes along. So if that kind of trade comes along, obviously you would still make the trade if it was worth it. Like if you're trading pennies for a dollar, then you do it anyway. But then all of a sudden you kind of have to rejigger this thing again around whatever player you just acquired. And so again, you do it, but it does sort of feel like, all right, what's the plan? Because if the plan is to eventually do that, then are you really building around those three or four guys like Winderman is reporting here, or are you just sort of doing it Or is it just sort of this kind of bridge to whatever that is? And if it's a bridge, well, then what kind of players are you looking at acquiring? Right? Are you just looking to do the next 1 year James Johnson, 1 year deal Deion Waiters type of thing? Right. Are you trying to get off of these other contracts? Are you trying to get, will you get rid of future assets in order to get off of some of these contracts? Like, what does it look like, and how long does it look like that?
Yeah, and you mentioned in the original question about how they approach the draft, and I mean, we've heard rumors that the team is willing to move that pick if they can land that superstar, but I mean, in the absence of that move panning out, who do you select? I mean, do you select somebody who is a replacement for Goran and James Johnson, or do you select somebody who's a replacement for, you know, Josh or Justice even at some point?
Right. Do you avoid taking best player available because that best player available might overlap with Justice, Josh, or Bam? Right. Because if you swerve away from best player available, and then you end up trading, like, let's say, I don't know, let's say Brandon Clark is there and he's the best player available based on their board, but you don't take him because you have Bam Adebayo. But then a month later, you turn around and trade Bam Adebayo, and then you could have really used a guy like Brandon Clark. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, like, all right, so when the draft comes along, are you drafting to fit? Are you drafting for a fit? Or are you drafting to accumulate more assets in order to eventually make a trade? Now, maybe we're looking at this too black and white, David. I don't know. Maybe you could do both at the same time. Just go get the player who is good and fits your system and just sort of build around that. But it's a question worth asking because I want to know. You know, right. You look at teams like the Hawks. You look at teams like the Kings. You look at teams like these teams suck right now, but at least they have a plan, right? Like you could see the blueprint in Atlanta. They are not interested in trading Trae Young or John Collins for Jimmy Butler, right? But you know, the Kings aren't interested in moving De'Aaron Fox or Marvin Bagley for an upgrade. The Heat, I don't know where they stand. Are you building around these guys or are you not? And you got to figure it out, because if you're not, all right, fine. That's great. At least we know. And if you're not, make the move now and approach the draft and free agency that way.
Right. And look, you could make an argument that the draft is probably at the wrong point in the calendar year, that it should take place after free agency so that you can meet whatever needs you have to be a free agency, and then you can draft to fill whatever remaining needs you have. I mean, that's an argument that some people have made. I can see the defense in the opposite end also. But what if you draft a player then? And like you said, what if the move to acquire a star or a more established veteran player doesn't pan out until July or August before training camp starts? And then whatever team you're engaging in talks with doesn't want whatever player you selected at 13th. Maybe you went and took a chance on a Hachimura or a Langford, and they were like, no, thanks, too many red flags about those players, not interested in either of them. And then you're kind of stuck with an asset that's already been devalued just a month or two after its selection, you know. And obviously it could pan out in the other way too, where you could say you could draft a player that maybe had lower expectations and then they could have a strong showing in Las Vegas Summer League, and all of a sudden then that becomes like, you know, like a Kyle Kuzma. Nobody expected Kyle Kuzma to have the strong showing he did a couple seasons ago, and I don't imagine the Lakers would have been able to trade him in you know, August later on that year for anything less than a star or veteran player, you know, so...
Well, the other way this impacts things, too, is you can kind of look at it the way that the 76ers looked at it and said, we're building around Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. The hell with these draft picks and future assets. Let's trade for Jimmy Butler. Let's trade for Tobias Harris. We think that they fit around these guys well. Now, they may have been wrong in that, but that's what they did, right? That was their blueprint, and so they ended up doing that. The Heat could do the same thing. The Heat could say, well, these are three or four guys, if you include Derrick Jones Jr. We don't need the 13th pick. The hell with this pick. Let's move it for Mike Conley. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that next, as well as if the Michigan job is the right fit for Juwan Howard. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Today's show is brought to you in part by Hotels.com. Don't hate like your friend's trip. Book your own with Hotels.com and get rewarded basically everywhere. Hotels.com, be there, do that, get rewarded. And Untuck It, dads come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and so do their shirts, like tall, short, slim, relaxed. Ever wonder why your father's button-ups look so long and baggy at the end of the day? It can be hard for guys to pull off a casual, untucked look that isn't sloppy. That's where Untuck It comes in. Untuck It is a solution that fits just right. Their shirts are specifically designed to look great, untucked, and feel comfortable at work or on the weekend. No tucking or tailoring required. Go to untuckit.com, promo code NBA to get 20% off. All right, we're going to talk about the series finale of Game of Thrones later on, but let's get to some Heat news here. Juwan Howard reportedly in the mix for the Michigan head coaching job, according to ESPN, and is expected to interview for the position. Would this be a good move for him, David?
I think it's the opportunity he's looking for. I mean, he had interviewed for head coaching jobs in the NBA, and it's not difficult for him to make that transition. If he's happy at Michigan, he'd stay there for a longer time. But I think it's also a good building block, and it gets him the kind of experience that might shy NBA teams and NBA front offices from extending that offer to him at the NBA level. So if he can prove that he's a good head coach at the collegiate level, that's a good springboard for him to eventually take a job down the line as an NBA-worthy head coach. Having said that, I don't know that I'd make that move. I mean, I know I'm not being offered either position, but at the same time, I'm not sure that handling the college game is where Juwan is at. I think he's used to dealing with adults. I think he's used to dealing with younger adults maybe, but at the same time still players that are professionals and all that entails. He had a long NBA career. He's distanced himself from the collegiate game for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I think understanding the nuances of recruiting, understanding the nuances of NCAA regulations, how to juggle the one and done system is immensely challenging. I can't say that it's a good opportunity for him, to be honest with you. I understand he could be looking at it as one, but I think it would be very, very difficult for an NBA coach and a former NBA player to kind of succeed in that role. I know that I'm drawing a blank here. What's his name? Fred Hoiberg had some success in that role, but I don't know if Juwan is necessarily that same cut from the same cloth. You know what I'm saying?
And Hoiberg is, go Cyclones and everything, but Ohio State is very different than Michigan, right?
Yeah. It's a weird decision. I don't know that you can continue to wait. I guess it all depends on money too. I mean, how much is he going to get paid at Michigan?
Right. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I mean, the one and done thing too. I mean, John Beilein, who recently left Michigan for the Cavs job, that's why the job's open. Right. He didn't really build a one and done type program.
Mm-hmm.
There, guys go there for 2-3 years, and Juwan Howard, I think, he is a player development guy, and so I think in that respect, he would do well with guys out of high school and coaching them up and getting them ready for the NBA. I think he would kill it in recruiting for that reason. He's like, look, I've coached in the NBA. I've won championships at the NBA level as a coach, as a player. I can get you ready for that level. I know what it takes. And so I think that would really help him. Now, I'm with you, though. He kind of has distanced himself from the college game. He's taken a lot of head coaching interviews at the NBA level this summer. He seems to be a hot name right now. I don't know if I would jump at the Michigan thing right away, unless he absolutely loves Michigan still, right? And I'm sure he loves Michigan, but if he wants to, there's a difference between loving Michigan and watching them in the tournament versus I want to be in charge of that program. If he loves it to that level and wants to and elevate Michigan to that level, okay, I could see it. Recruiting is easy there. Not easy, I shouldn't say, but you have a substantial foundation there to build on. It's not just any college basketball job. It is Michigan. They're consistently in the tournament. They're consistently successful. There's a lot to like there, but it's a very different thing than coaching in the NBA. Coaching at the NBA is basically like coaching in the NBA. It's coaching basketball. Where in college, you're dealing with, limited practices and all these weird rules that you and things that you have to get around. Do you want to cheat or do you not want to cheat? You've got to actually think about that at the college level, right? Do I want to skirt some of these regulations or do I want to abide by all of them and almost have a disadvantage against all the people that are skirting by these regulations? Like these are things you have to think about. I don't know that Juwan Howard wants to do the politics of college basketball. Right. If he does, go for it. If the money's great and good enough for you to deal with it, good. Go for it. I do think it would be, if he wants to coach at an NBA level though, stay in the NBA. You're better off staying in the NBA, even as an assistant, versus going to college as a head coach, because now all of a sudden you have the college coach stigma.
Look at
and
David Fizdale.
It's hard to get over that. Yep.
Fizdale was a great example of that. He was one of those names that was perpetually linked to coaching opportunities. He interviewed, stuck it out as an assistant, and then eventually got his chance there. And once you're making it as he's already gotten the head coaching opportunity with Memphis. He almost immediately got hired by the New York Knicks shortly thereafter. He's getting paid by two different franchises now. And if anything were to happen with the Knicks, he'd still continue to get paid from them as well. So, I mean, it's a great opportunity, man. I don't know that you do that if you're Juwan and go to Michigan like that. I don't know. It's interesting to see it play out, though.
Let's continue with that conversation we were having in the first segment about Mike Conley, because on a recent podcast, Zach Lowe reported the Heat will be aggressive on the trade and sign trade market. Sean Devenny of the Sporting News reported that the Heat could be willing to give up the 13th pick to get Mike Conley from Memphis, and they'd be the only team, presumably in the lottery, willing to give up a lottery pick for Mike Conley. Now, I talked about this at the start of Tuesday's show, David, before I went on with Brendan Klein to talk about the NBA Draft Combine, but I want to get your take on this and sort of, again, continuing a conversation from earlier in the show. You know, is a guy like, let's start with Conley, is a guy like Conley somebody that does complement that core of Justice, Josh, Bam, and presumably Derek Jones Jr.?
I think it could work. I think you minimize, you know, Justice Winslow's role a little bit. He's no longer going to be the team's point guard. But at the same time, I think a player like Conley has enough experience playing with guys like that, like playmakers at other positions, and he knows how to get everybody involved. And I think he's a fair floor general. I mean, I know that's a kind of cliche title, but I think he handles it pretty well. And he's also aggressive enough to get his shot. And I think that's something that Miami's current roster is lacking. So I think there's a great fit for him here, a great opportunity for him to establish himself as a top level point guard. I mean, I think he's already there, obviously, but it's just been so difficult for him to prove it at the all-star level, because, you know, there are so many other worthy candidates in the Western Conference where he's played his whole career. So as far as his fit, I think I could definitely see him working well with the team's current roster, depending on what you have to give up in order to acquire him. So I think Devini had, you know, the 13th pick and maybe Goran Dragic or Dion in addition to that. I mean, that's... Yep. I guess that's a fair trade, and I guess that you get to unload...
Who don't you like? You seem hesitant. Like, who don't you like it for? Kind of. Like,
for Memphis, yeah. I mean, you know, they're going to move it's on. They're going to be rebuilding right away. Yeah, so it's not a bad fit for them one way or the other.
From Miami's it depends on if Dragic opts in, too. Should mention that.
Yes. No, without a doubt. You know, look, there are concerns. I mean, he's 31, pushing 32 by the time training camp starts. So, and he's going to get paid $67 million over the next two seasons. That's a lot for a 34, almost 35-year-old point guard.
And it eats into Miami's cap space in 2020, so that's why it's even more paramount to not only get one of those Dion Waiters type of contracts off the books in that deal, but maybe even get a second one. Like, down the road, you'd have to trade either James Johnson or Kelly Olynyk as well, if you want to maintain that flexibility in order to sign another max, which might be good. Like, if you're able to pitch a free agent next summer Justice Winslow, Mike Conley, Josh Richardson, Bam Adebayo. Like, you can fit in somewhere around there. That's not a bad pitch. I don't know if it's the best one. You add that to Pat Riley, Eric Spoelstra, South Beach, blah, blah, blah. And if Miami's able to... Mike Conley definitely raises their ceiling. It makes them, and raises their floor, too. Because what Conley can give you is consistency on offense, and he's not a guy that's going out and scoring 28 points per game. But I looked this up, David. The Heat didn't have a single player on the roster, not even Dwayne Wade, not a single player on the roster, not Goran Dragic, who was in the top half of the league as far as running the pick and roll via percentile, like NBA. And that percentile is based on, you know, the amount of possessions that player uses in pick and roll versus how often his team scores in such situations.
And where did
And Mike Conley is like in the 80th percentile. Like, he's very good.
Yeah.
He's one of the top 10 or 15 guys in the league and has been for years, right? We know that he had a great two-man game with Marc Gasol, but when Gasol was gone, he still thrived in pick-and-roll situations. So having Conley at least allows you to run pick-and-roll. Justice Winslow's jumper has come a long way. He can flank that pick-and-roll just like Josh Richardson can. He can run that pick-and-roll with Bam Adebayo running to the rim, or Kelly Olynyk picking and popping.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a good fit. You don't lose anything defensively, you know. A lot of these pick and roll point guards are not good defenders. Conley is the rare exception to that. I love the fit, but there's just other, like, in a vacuum, I love the fit. Is it worth giving up the 13th pick? Look, if you want to kind of go Philadelphia in like little mini process version, that's sort of what this would look like. If you're building around these four guys, Conley fits around those four guys. And, you know, are you willing to take that risk of having, you know, older Mike Conley making 30 plus million for the next 2 years That's tough, but if you can find a way to get off of more of these contracts, and look, maybe Mike Conley going into next season is even more tradable than he is right now in Memphis. He'll be on an expiring contract. Maybe you're able to get off of that deal if you have to, if the right free agent comes along. I don't know. I think there's I feel like I'm talking myself into this, honestly. I guess it would depend on who's there at 13 when the draft comes along. This would have to be a draft night deal.
I think they don't view the 13th pick as anything more than just a ho-hum type level player. And I think if that's where they're willing to throw it in for a guy like Conley with all, maybe baggage is not the right word, but the concerns for somebody of his age and his contract, if they're willing to include it, then it also kind of flies in the face of exactly what we were talking about in the first segment, that they're not really building around this young core. I mean, they're building around this young core. If they were really building around this young core, wouldn't the 13th pick make more sense? Like, whatever player is available there as being a complementary level player to kind of go at the same pace?
I mean, what does building around this young core look like? Like I said, is it Philadelphia where you want to add some veterans who can win now and elevate your Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid young duo that you're building around? Or do you look at it as, no, we need to draft Markelle Fultz? Like, what process of building around this young core are you in? You know, and I, like, again, I think it matters who's there at 13. Like, if Kevin Porter Jr. and Sekou Doumbouya and Rui Hachimura, these guys who we think would be good fits, or let's say they're all off the board by the time the Heat pick at 13, there's nobody that they really like, then maybe they say, the hell with it. Like, there's nobody on the board right now that we love. Let's go ahead and get Mike Conley. Because Conley's not going to step on the toes of any of these young guys.
What's the position of need? Obviously, John Morant, who they're drafting with a second overall pick, or likely will be drafting with a second overall pick. So what's another position of need for Memphis? Obviously, they're set at the...
Oh, wing. Yeah, they just go get more wings. Go get guys. Like, Nasir Little would be a good fit for them. your favorite. Jaren Jackson is, you know, their 4 or 5, depending on what they're looking at. Like, can you move 13 and Hassan Whiteside to Memphis? Like, do they want, like, the expiring contract of Whiteside? You could talk yourself into playing Whiteside next to Jaren Jackson, since Jaren could space the floor, doesn't have to play full-time center at this young, blah, blah, blah. Or do you just try to grab another sort of combo big man who can sort of be versatile with Jaren Jackson Jr. there? A Brandon Clark makes sense for them.
They don't even have a head coach?
Well, they've got Ryan Saunders. Oh, no, Memphis. We're talking about Memphis, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have a head coach right now, so who needs it? All right, let's take a break. We'll have some Game of Thrones talk next. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Today's show is brought to you by Grip 6, where their goal is to literally make the best belt that's ever been made. Grip 6 is an easy, thoughtful gift for dads, brothers, husbands, uncles, grandpas, moms, and wives. It's ultra lightweight with no holes, no flap, and it carries a low profile with the buckle laying flat against the waist, making the belt super comfortable. Grip 6 is the only belt with no holes, no flap, and no bulk. And today, Grip 6 has a special offer for you. Check it out at grip6.com/lock. And remember, to get this show every day, subscribe to Locked On Heat on the new Himalaya podcast app. In an ever-expanding podcast world, you need Himalaya with our personally curated playlists, constantly updated new features. Download Himalaya at your app store and subscribe to Locked On Heat. Thank you to our sponsors, Hotel.com, thank you to Untuck It, and thank you to Grip 6 Belts. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're on iTunes, rate us, review us, say nice things about us. All right, basketball talk is over. If you want to avoid spoilers or don't care about Game of Thrones, go ahead and stop the pod now. We'll be back later in the week with another Blue Notebook show. David, Game of Thrones is over. What did you think of the series finale? What did you think about where it landed and how everything wrapped up?
I enjoyed it. I'll be honest with you, I did. I think it's difficult to kind of process any kind of series finale, especially if you enjoy the show as much as I think as we did, and a number of millions of people enjoyed the show as much as we did. So I don't know that there would have been any ending that could have summed it all perfectly and ended it. I think they tied everything pretty well together. It answered some questions, and I had some issues with some things. I think the death of Daenerys, we had talked about that the previous week. I think that was a foregone conclusion. Like, there was no way that she could survive
Right.
After having done what she did, after taking the turn, it was clear that they were setting this up from the beginning of the season, that, you know, she was already distancing herself, that she already had some questions about her relationship with Jon, about, you know, about his pursuit of the throne or not. You know, so there, those were pretty clearly established there. And after having roasted all of King's Landing alive, I think she was set up to be the fall person. And I mean, it just,
yeah, and they wrote towards that ending, and that was obvious. I still the John and Danny thing, I like, they just ended up being different characters than who they were. And I get, like, part of that is just, okay.
Okay, and what's that? It's character development. Explain that one to me, because I'm not sure how I see it, to be honest.
So, Danny was, like, in the first, I don't know, six seasons of the show, whatever. You know, she was supposed to be the breaker of the wheel and all this stuff, and she wanted to really, like, you know, free people who had been enslaved, and she kept talking about that, but, like, I don't know. It felt like they were just sort of throwing those lines in. Mm-hmm. It didn't really feel like she was that person anymore. Like, she wasn't the character who would just, like, flip on a switch while she was just looking at the Red Keep. We talked about our issues with that in the last week, but, like, that, to me, it felt unearned. Like, I still don't really buy it, how we got to where, like, her becoming the Mad Queen, I just didn't buy it. It just didn't feel earned to me, and, like, I get, like, there was foreshadowing.
Not just foreshadowing. I mean, we've been seeing this slowly for seasons. I saw a post about this, but I mean, I had even come to this conclusion on my own. I mean, season one, she saw her brother destroyed, killed in one of the most ghastly deaths in all of the series, and she was kind of like, "Huh."
So that's what happened. Because her brother had been torturing her since she was literally a little kid. Like, that was a long plot, right? Like, that was long and drawn out. I just felt like this, like, that made sense. That, to me, just like, I still don't.
But she's,
I just don't buy it. All it's like Benioff and Weiss saying, like, how she was looking at the Red Keep and everything it meant to her and her family. I'm like, and so she torched a million people, like a
couple thousand anyway.
It's just, all right. I didn't buy it anyway. The Jon Snow thing also, isn't he supposed to be like, I do this for the realm, I'm the protector of the people, blah blah blah. I'm, you know, as stubborn as he is, he's sure about what he believes in, and he's always been that way. And he just can't get over this Danny chick for whatever reason, who, by the way, he won't, like, hook up with her anymore because he's weirded out about the whole situation, but is still so in love with her that he's struggling with this decision. It's like, okay, no, but what really are you? What's the deal? What's, like, how do you really feel? Because we can't figure it out. You're, like, kind of flip-flopping all the time. And then all it takes is one conversation with Tyrion, like one really sketched out debate with Tyrion for him to flip the switch. Like, no, I just felt like he went in there saying, that's my queen, that's my queen, that's my queen. And Tyrion was like, but she totally sucks, right? And he was like, yeah, good point.
I mean, I think you're kind of simplifying things a little bit too much there. I think the reality is that he was always questioning where Danny was headed, that he had seen signs before, that he'd heard about what happened with the Tarleys a couple of seasons ago. I think we'd already started to see enough evidence there that Danny might be kind of heading down a dark path. And I think that he was kind of questioning that. And I think that's fine. I don't know that he's always been so sure. I mean, you say he's been sure of himself. I think he's had a good moral compass, you know, given to him or taught to him by Ned. But at the same time, I think that compass kind of wavers a little bit sometimes. And he does question his decision-making process. He doesn't always know if he's doing the right thing. He thinks he's doing the most honorable thing. But sometimes, you know, he could want... Look, he's made decisions that have not been the right ones. And I think he accepts that he's not perfect.
I enjoyed the callback to the, you know, duty is the death of love, or love is the death of duty, whatever it was. I enjoyed that callback. That was solid. What were some of your issues with it then? Like, if it wasn't the Danny and John thing,
I don't like the selection of Bran as the king.
Yeah,
I think I like the idea that all these characters that had, you know, maybe were secondary tier characters like Brienne and Ser Davos and others had a seat at the table and continue to do so even after Bran had been.
How did Bronn survive this whole thing?
Because
it's unbelievable. Yeah. That's what he does. He's a survivor. But sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack you. But
no, Bran, no, no, no. You're
the
right.
Bran thing. the Bran thing, just to me, I didn't have an issue as much with Bran on the throne. I didn't really care about who ended up being king as much as other people did. I just thought that was sort of...
I had a theory it was going to be Tyrion. I thought Tyrion would be king. I thought he was... I thought it would have been a more interesting, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I had pitched the idea that maybe it would have been a more interesting thing if he had been planning this from the whole time. Like, he had set up everything. He already knew that Danny was going to turn mad.
I wouldn't have bought that either. Like, that, they would have done a lot of explaining. The thing about Bran is, I don't care that he's king. I want to know what his deal is. Like, I still don't know what his powers are. Like, the most we've ever really understood about Bran's powers, like, that's the only thing about I cared about him. About
he's gonna warg into the dragon. That's for sure. Like, he's
right.
Gonna,
the most we've ever explored that aspect of him is the Hodor episode. Like, yes. Since then, we haven't learned anything more about specifically the extent of his powers. Right.
Well, he can take over a whole flock of, or a murder of crows.
All right. True. I mean, that's pretty cool. But I want to know more about Bran. Like, we're making him king. Like, and that weird line is like, why did you think I made it all this way? And it's just like, I don't know. Tell me. Like, say more things. You say like four words at a time. Explain yourself.
Yeah.
I wanted to know. They needed to do a better job of that. Whether it was Bran saying it or somebody else figuring it out. I just want to, like, he had that whole conversation with Tyrion. Like, earlier in the season, what was that conversation about?
They didn't even show it. It was like
they didn't even show it. I was like, would we have learned more? I don't know. Right. I don't know. So, I don't really mind how we, like, where we ended up. It's how we got there. I just didn't buy it. Like, I didn't buy the whole Tyrion thing saying, like, who has a better story than Bran? I don't know. Any of the characters that weren't written out of the show for an entire season probably had a better story than Bran. Like, dude falls out of a window in the first episode, and that's
pushed,
what we, like,
pushed.
You know, it depends on who you ask. Sansa. Way better story.
No.
Arya, get out of way here. Better story. She's a killer assassin. I don't know. Jon Snow, who you just figured out was actually a Targaryen and was stabbed to death and brought back to life. His story seems a little bit more interesting than Bran, who fell out of a pushed out of a window. So many people had a better story. Gendry had a better story. He was sitting right there.
Nah, he wasn't king. He wasn't king material.
Bran's king material?
No, those rallies are going to be terrible. Like, him being wheeled out there by Sir Podrick to a crowd, and he's going to be like, hey, and then that's it. That's everybody's going to be like, hey, say something, cheer us on, give us a reason to live. And he's going to be like, nope.
It's like, the reason is you.
I have to go now.
Like, I just, again, Tyrion. If you ask the question, who has a better story than Bran, several other people should have raised their hands and be like, want to read my Wikipedia page?
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting one. I don't know. But it felt like, at the very least, they kind of wrapped things up well, right? I mean, yeah. I don't know how else they could have done it, to be honest with you.
They wrote themselves into a corner, and that was it. And
what happens next for Jon Snow?
Well, I like the Jon Snow thing. I hate being nitpicky guy and just being like the hater of the Game of Thrones, because I really wanted to like it, and I did ultimately. Still one of my favorite shows ever. It's going to go down as one of my favorite shows of all time. I loved so much of this show. It's just going to be one of those shows where I look back on it, like, when I rewatch this, I'll probably rewatch the first six seasons, and I'm probably not going to watch the last two.
Ooh.
And that'll be it, you know? Because the first most of the show is awesome. But anyway, didn't love how they ended up sending Jon north to the wall. Still not exactly sure why they need people there, but love how they got them there, basically being like, well, Grey Worm said he wanted to kill you, but we got a good compromise. We're just going to exile you. And then Grey Worm gets on a boat like 4 minutes later, and they're like, all right, well, call Jon, tell him to come back, because Grey Worm's not here, because Grey Worm's only... influence was that he was there with an entire army that wants to kill Jon. Once that army is gone, he has no influence. He has no capital.
Were they going to report it on the Westeros version of the internet? Was there, you know, going to be like a news bulletin? Was the Westeros Woes going to be like, oh, Jon Snow's back, total fake out?
They were all standing on the docks. Yeah. Like Jon was still on the dock when Grey Worm got on his boat and left. He could have just been like, oh, he just left? Oh. Sweet. I'm just going to, like, can I just
come back
here?
And stay as king?
Yeah. Like, just, hey, put the sheets back on. I'm good. Like, Anyway, didn't love that. I did predict that John was going to end up at the wall, north of the wall with the Wildlings, with Ghost. I thought ultimately that's what was going to happen because that's where he's always been most comfortable. That's where the love of his life that didn't, you know, that didn't murder millions of people lived before she died. Right. But it made sense for him to be back there. I like that he's back there. And I loved the final scene of him walking into this forest somewhere north of the wall, surrounded by children. Really good, like, just a good callback to the children of the forest, who we know were the first people to basically settle in Westeros, right? Where the children of the forest, they're the first people to settle in Westeros. And so it kind of does seem like, okay, Jon is going north with these new kids, and maybe he's going to start a new civilization wherever he is going. And I love that. I love that that was how they ended it.
I hadn't even considered that, to be honest with you.
It was a good visual.
Now that you say it, it does make a lot of sense, and there's a good opportunity there for something to build on. Like, I wish there was going to be, we've already heard talk that there's going to be spinoff shows, right? But I think those are more prequels. I don't know that anything's going to deal with the story of what happens after
Arya. I kind of, like, Arya was seemed like it was being set up for a sequel a little bit. Like,
I mean, that's kind of opening, west right? Like, what's west of Westeros? Yeah.
Where in the world does Arya start, kind of thing?
Yeah. I could see that one. That one seems like it's much more easy to kind of pigeonhole there. And you don't ever have to have any kind of connection to any other character in the show, right? Because she's on her own. She's outside of Westeros completely. So.
And they set her up as the best character in that final season, too. Like, if you weren't all in on Arya, you are now, you know?
Yeah. Did you think she was going to kill Dany? Do you think she was going to be the person?
No.
I mean, I didn't see it either.
No, you can't. Like I said, you can't. It's like, that would be like Kawhi hitting the game winner and then the game going into overtime and then him hitting another game winner. It's like, no, you only get one of these. Like, it would have been overkill. Right. I like that they didn't. I actually thought that I kept reading a bunch of fan theories that Varys ended up poisoning her, and that's why she looked sickly when she was like looking out the window in the second to last episode when Tyrion was there.
Yeah, we already know, like, that she didn't. She wasn't eating.
Right. Well, she wasn't eating, but maybe she was also poisoned because, like, she wasn't. That was one of, like, I guess when you get poisoned in the Game of Thrones universe, you also lose your appetite. So this all made sense according to what I was reading on the internet. So I was like, okay, that would be kind of cool if, like, Varys died, but, like, his lasting gift was to, like, also have Dany go out with him. Like, that would have been kind of cool. And it would have been, like, on brand for basically not giving us a murderous scene, which was, like, the dumb Cersei death, died by rock, you know, kind of thing. But
was it the ultimate betrayal by Jon to, like, make out with Daenerys and then stab her? Like, couldn't he have just, like, beheaded her or something like that? Did he have to be, like, looking into her eyes and saying, no, you'll always be my queen? Yeah, sorry.
Psych.
At least for the next 10 seconds, anyway, you'll be just my, like, queen.
Borat voice, not, like, at the very end.
It did seem a little unusually cruel.
Shout out to Drogon for, I don't know, knowing what the throne was and understanding everything it meant in that moment and knowing that it was the ultimate demise of Dany and not the dude that just stabbed her in the stomach.
Right.
Like, shout out to that awareness.
That is pretty impressive.
Never saw that from a dragon before, but that's very cool. By Iron Throne. That's great. I don't know. Those are all my thoughts for Game of Thrones at this point.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I still love the show. I still even love the season. I think it was kind of, I think the word I used to describe it the following day was somewhat anticlimactic, but good at the same time because it had to kind of just wrap everything up. I think, honestly, for me, the high point of the season was Arya, the death of the Night King, and the Battle of Winterfell. And then from that point on, it was just kind of like, all right, we're picking up steam, heading into home, and we're not quite sure how to get our footing, so let's just kind of do everything we can as quickly as possible. I mean, look, there were obviously missteps there. I won't go so far as to say we should complain about it.
We don't need to redo the whole season. So that petition, no. Come on now.
Don't fill it out then.
Don't fill it out. One last thought. Tyrion did some real heavy lifting those final two or three episodes, because he was basically explaining the entire story and what was going on. He was kind of leading the charge with everything. Heavy scenes for Tyrion, and good for him, but also
Peter Dinklage.
Peter Dinklage, absolutely. It kind of does also illustrate the writing problem that show had. It was like, oh, we killed everybody that is smart and kind of moves the story forward. Oh, crap. All right. Well, just look. I guess we'll just have Tyrion say literally all the important things.
Can I say something else? After the Battle of Winterfell, when the Dothraki hordes had been reduced to, like, nothing, how were there, like, hundreds of them there for that final battle?
It's not only the Dothraki, but the Unsullied, it's an elastic amount of people. Like, it's different based on the needs of the scene.
Did they clone themselves by the hundreds? Yeah. I don't know.
I thought we killed all of them. It turns out we only killed a few of them. Turns out that they had plenty to go into the battle.
They were faking like, oh, no, I don't want to fight the Night King. Oh, and they were just like rolling over and then they pop back up and like, yep, healthy as ever. Good for us.
White Walkers, Dragonfire, not enough to completely eliminate them. So, thanks for listening. Connect with us on Twitter using the hashtag AskElloHeat. Email us at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. We'll be back later in the week. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.